chapter into action, page 88. We're going to, with 10 and 11, we're going to continue to turn statements into questions, but we're going to basically look at three different things. We're going to look at the 10th step as an exercise to use when you're moving out in the day through the world, rather than an evening review that some people think is continuing to take inventory. The evening review and the daily inventory is not part of the 10th step. It's the biggest mistake Bill made between the big book and the 12 and 12. But we will find nothing in the 10th step except the short form of it itself, continue to take inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. We'll find nothing in the 10th step about daily inventory. The 10th step is about proper use of the will and moving out into the world and what to watch for and how to turn from it when it crops up. So we're going to look at the 10th step as a set of instructions to use throughout the day. Then we're going to look at the 11th step in two parts. Even though it does mention a few things to do throughout the day, pause when agitated or doubtful, ask for the right thought or action, etc., etc. We're basically going to look at the 11th step, which includes prayer and meditation, obviously, as something to do in the morning, where it says upon awakening, and something to do in the evening, where it says when we retire at night. With the 12th step, the last section, section 14, step 12, we're going to look from obviously the end of into action to the 164th page. That basically we'll look in three parts. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps is what's happened on, based on the work we've done up to that point through the first 11. Carrying the message, the best part of the book to use for that, and I've known a lot of people that recommend before you even go on a 12-step call, it's great to read Working with Others. That's basically a diagram of how to pitch a drunk, but it doesn't talk about how to work with somebody once they've decided they're ready to go through the recovery process. It's like from your initial meeting up to them accepting and what this book has to offer. And then practicing these principles in all our affairs, I think a lot of us, me included, for a long time, disregarded that those next chapters, from the end of Working with Others to page 164, outline a lot of the principles and places where we practice those principles for almost every area of our life. So those are the basic notes for those that have been writing that down. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I think if anybody goes very long, I would, from my experience, there's no reason, although a lot of us have gone past our first year before getting involved in making amends, I think if somebody goes very long or goes a period of sobriety, as I've met some who've gone their entire sobriety, never getting involved in the amends process. And by getting involved in the amends process, I don't just mean waking up one day and starting to make amends. Waking up one day and realizing you owe somebody some amends is not the same as the experience you have with 1 through 8 and then going out to make amends. It's a cumulative experience. And I have personal experience to prove that to myself. In a moment of guilt and frustration and untreated alcoholism in Denver, where I got sober, before doing 1 through 8, set off to make some amends to a brother in Albuquerque because he lived nearby, and I had not been in Denver that long and had been pretty much isolated the last year of my drinking. I only spent my last year of drinking in Denver to have caused a lot of harm in Denver, but I had this tremendous guilt that hadn't been healed from the work yet, and set out to go to Albuquerque to make amends to a brother that I'd caused some real harm to so I could feel better. And went down to Albuquerque and said, you know, I got really embarrassed and I was overwhelmed with guilt and I had no clarity that comes from the first eight steps and I basically had no power. And I said to him, I was really sorry, and he said, I know you are. You always have been, but what are you going to do? And I wasn't clear on what I could do, and I just made a mess of it. I later had to go back and make amends for making amends. And so when I say, if you've never gotten involved in making amends, I don't mean waking up one day and deciding to start making amends. I mean doing the work up to the ninth step and then getting involved in the ninth step work is an experience that I would hate for anyone in AA to ever miss. I think it's, 10 and 11 and 12 are a really exciting time, and 10 and 11, when amends are finished, everyone you're consciously aware of that you could possibly do to make right, and there is no one in your world, in your life, that you owe anything, is a really exciting time. But up to that day, and the realization of that from your head to your heart, the most exciting time in my recovery has always been in amends. I mean, you have those days where things are just clicking and you know who it is on the phone when it rings and you're in the right spot at the right time and people you need to see are showing up. I mean, you hear stories around this country of people that have been fortunate to make amends of pulling up to a stoplight and there pulls right up next to them somebody they haven't seen for 20 years, they never thought they were going to be able to find. And there's just, I mean, the real miracle stories start to happen. I'll tell you a few of mine. So I've got my card, and I think we've been pretty damn thorough. So I was surprised when Terry told me the amount of time we have left in a 12-hour set of tapes. I think we've been pretty damn thorough through step eight. But then is the most exciting, 9, 10, 11, and 12. I mean, it's what all this is for. I mean, everything we've done is getting us ready to turn out to the world and clean up this stuff in the past so we can be here in the moment. I see that as the goal now. I do this work so I can practice the presence of God in the moment where I like to be. And I don't ever want to drink again. So I've got this pile of cards, and it helps me to put them in piles. Those that I'm willing to do and I know where they are. Those that I'm not willing to do and I know where they are. Those that I'm willing to do and I don't know where they are. And those that I'm not willing to do and I don't know where they are. And it's obvious. You start with the ones that you're willing to do and you know where they are, and you just start making them. And like I said, by the time you're almost done with the ones you have pluses on, you will have had some new willingness be created for you to do the ones you have a negative by, just from the power and freedom that comes. So I started making amends. I needed a format, though. I needed, there was something I wanted to say last session before we stopped that I didn't get to say that really pissed me off once, so I thought I would share it with you guys so I could piss all of you off once. I mean, you pass that stuff on, basically, right? This guy came to our group in Santa Monica. We were about 4 years old, which meant I was eight. And he said, I'm not talking about the 12th step, because there's people all over the country doing great stuff with 12-step work. He said, I'm talking about steps 10 and 11. And I'm talking about why people spend so much time on the promises halfway through the ninth step on page 83 and so little time on the promises a couple pages later in the 10th step that are miraculous promises. He says, why don't we hear those 10th step promises talked about more? And he said, why is it so hard to find people around this country practicing 10 and 11? I mean, really doing stuff with prayer and meditation and learning about proper use of the will. He says, you'll find very little in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous past the 9th step, because no one ever finishes. It would be like if you went somewhere in this country and no one ever finished 4, you'd probably find not much about 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. Well, if you don't ever get to a place where you're done with 9, and when I say done with 9, don't misconstrue what I'm saying. I'm not saying you're never going to make another amend. You're never going to cause any more harm. I'm not talking about from today forward. Of course I'm going to have more amends. Of course I'm going to cause some more harm. And if I ever speak to any of you, or you ever see me again and I say that I haven't caused any harm in a long time, just smack me across the face because I'm lying. Right? I don't mean that there won't ever be any more amends and I'm done with amends. I mean the ones that have been revealed to me from the day I've gotten here until today, I've gone back and cleaned up. And that's a day you don't want to miss. And that doesn't always happen the day it's done. That doesn't always happen the day you realize in your head that you're done with amends. It sometimes takes guys like me a while for that to go from your head to your heart, as a lot of these ideas I've shared with you this weekend take that dubious path between your head and your heart that sometimes takes an instant and sometimes takes a lifetime. I like the ones now that happen in your heart before your head, those things that happen before you understand what it was that just happened. But those are few and far between for me. But I have had days, not since my first time through the work. I'm 11 and a half years sober, so I've been through the work approximately 11 times. I did not finish amends my first time through the work, and I paid a hell of a price. Came real close to drinking again. And I did not finish amends the first time I moved to California when I was 4, that time through the work. So I do not say I've been through the work 11. Don't tell people you've been through the steps if you have amends you haven't finished. That's another misconception. And don't keep doing these workshops over and over to keep doing 1 through 9 to avoid. Matter of fact, if I was living in a place where they do a lot of workshops like they do here, and it was me, I would make a personal commitment to myself. I am not going to another workshop until I finish the amends that I'm currently aware of. So you don't get in the habit, as we've seen all over this country, of 1 through 9 and a half, 1 through 9 and a half, 1 through 9 and a half, to keep from finishing some amends you don't want to make. It's a terrible pattern to get into. So I started making amends, and I flew back to Battle Creek, Michigan, where I caused most of my harm, lived the first 15 years of my life, and I'd been to Battle Creek 4 times before that, sober, before I got to amends. And each time I went to Battle Creek, Michigan, sober, I would go to an AA meeting with an old friend of mine that I sponsor now, that I grew up with. And then we would go to this club, and in all 4 of those visits, maybe I would see 1 or 2 people in that club that I knew from the past. The time that I went to Battle Creek with a stack of cards, besides my family, friends that I needed to find, and we went to an AA meeting, and then we went to that club. After being there 4 times within the last, I was not even a year yet and I'm in amends. In the last 11 months, I'd been there 4 times and never saw more than 1 or 2 people. The night that I was ready, the night that I was spiritually ready and went to an AA meeting and then to this nightclub, my friend and I, in that door, walked 13 people in chronological order that I knew them, that I needed to find on that trip to make amends to, and I set up appointments with every one of them. Another time, I have a star on my hand, that a tattoo, a man that was 34 when I was 17. He had 4 of us put a star, a 5-pointed star on our hands. All 4 of them are dead, and the man that had us put that there was like a... I was closer to him than I was to my father. He died in my arms of an overdose in Las Vegas, Nevada. After I got out of the penitentiary. And he had taken me in when I was on the run. He died in my arms of an overdose, and I had bought the dope, and he hadn't done any for a long time that killed him. And that'd be like kind of like how you'd feel about killing someone you were closer to than your father. And I made amends to his parents, and I made amends to his brother, because there was some harm that I caused. And there, I made amends to him through a letter. And I was in Vegas 3 or 4 times a year until my 5th birthday, and I could never go to his grave. And I didn't know why I couldn't go to his grave until the day that I could.
So many times you get free of something, and then you, by getting free of it, you see how bound you were. Like most of the time, I do not know how much fear I'm in until I'm out of it. And I do not know how angry I was until I'm free of it. And I woke up on my fifth birthday, we were there, four of us. And I woke up one morning, it was, hey, today is the day you're going. No resistance, no struggle. Called a driver, took him to a suburb of Las Vegas called Henderson, Nevada. Like I'd been going there every day for the last five, and I hadn't been there in I don't know how many years. Took him right to the graveyard, walked right up to the grave like I was just there yesterday, got down on my knees and made my amends and said what I needed to say, and looked down, and it was 15 years to the day of his funeral. It was the day of his death that I was there. It just blew my mind. Another time, when I moved to California, I had a list of four amends in California, even though I was living in Denver. I'm the kind of guy that can cause harm long distance without even living somewhere. And I had these four people on my list, and I flew to California. One of them was a girl I'd been in a relationship with, and I made an appointment with her, and then I found the other two, and I couldn't find one. And I wrote her name down on my 3x5 card, and then I put a question mark as to where she was, and then I said a prayer, and I went to speak at a meeting that I would never have gone to. Even living there, I wouldn't go to this meeting. And I went and I spoke there, and a girl comes up to me, and she said, oh, you got sober in Denver. I said, yeah. She said, do you know where Cindy so-and-so is? I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm looking for her. She says, oh, she lives three blocks from you in Santa Monica. Here's her address. The day that I prayed about it. After trying everything I could, that's kind of a spiritual statement right there. After trying everything I could, the way to make it was provided with little or no effort on my part. Some of you understand that. Then I went to the girl that I'd been in the relationship with, and here's what the format I follow. And I follow this form. The rule for me is if they can be seen face-to-face, do it face-to-face. Don't put off seeing anybody face-to-face if they can be seen face-to-face. So the exceptions would be a phone call or a letter. Make those two the exceptions. Or a graveside. And I don't care if I'm at a grave, on the phone, in a letter, or preferably face-to-face, this is the format I follow. So I go to this girl's house and I explain to her, whether she knows or not, she might be in the program and I still need to say it so it's said. And you'll find these directions throughout these next pages. As you know, I'm involved in recovery. And part of the program is that I look at my past and I write a personal inventory. And I've currently done that again. And then I'm asked to go back to the people I've harmed and make direct amends. And that's why I'm here, and you need to know that this is very important for me to stay sober to do this. That they understand I'm on a life and death errand. So the first thing I'm saying on this format is that I explain to you why I'm there in front of you. It's especially great for ex-girlfriends and ex-boyfriends so they don't get the idea you're there in their living room to get back together or any other reason. That could be good for ex-bosses. That could be good for numerous reasons. That they understand why you're there and that it's very important. Then I'm to discuss the harm that I'm clear on. That's where my card comes in handy. But I don't pull a card out. I've maybe gone in the bathroom and looked at it and said a little prayer and asked God to help me not forget any of this. It just takes away from it if you're sitting in front of somebody and you pull out a card and start reading. But I might, if it was a big one, before I left their house, go back in the bathroom and ask, and see if I missed anything that needs to be talked about before I leave, so I've been thorough. And I talk to them about this is the harm I'm clear on. So that's the second part of this format. I've talked about why I'm here and that it's very important. And number two, the harm that I'm clear on. I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. I do not talk about selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. I talk about this is what I lied to you about. This is what I took from you. This is what I lied to you about. This is what I did. These are some things I didn't do. These are the things that I'm clear on that I think harmed you. Then I ask, is there any other harm that I ever caused you that you need to tell me about? I used to be so arrogant, I thought it was more important for me to be clear on how I harmed you than you having a chance telling me how I harmed you. You're the one I need to hear it from. I now see question number three much more important than question number two. I'm there to talk to them about the harm I caused them, and it's really arrogant for me to think I know what I did that harmed them. They're the ones that know. But I also don't make them responsible for doing the work and the amends. It's a chance for them, if I have missed anything, for them to make me aware of anything else that I ever did that hurt them. Then number four is vitally important, and that is, now that we've got it all out on the table, do you need to tell me how any of this hurt you? That can be incredibly healing. So I've talked about why I'm there and that it's very important. The harm I'm clear on. Is there any other that I'm not aware of? And do you need to tell me how any of this hurts you? And then the magic question of all, which is what amends is. Is there anything I can do to make right the wrong? We fell into a trap in our group. In Santa Monica, when we heard these people talking about finishing amends, we started to think that finishing amends was making the approach. Finishing amends is not making the approach, it's doing what they ask you to do in the approach to the best of the ability you have from the power you've been given from God. I come to you and I've robbed you for $1,000. I don't think the amends is done when I walk away and we've talked about that I stole $1,000 from you. I've made my approach. I've done my part. But I'm going to write on the back of that card, pay back $1,000, and here's the agreement he and I came to. That's the next thing I wanted to say on number five. If it's financial, arrange the best deal you can. The book talks about that. But what's real handy is to put on the back of your card the agreement you made of what you would do to make right the wrong, and then put that in a new file card box. And as you make amends, start doing the things that they ask you to do. Some are ongoing, and they just have to be ongoing. They'll never be done. A mother, a father, children, a wife. But you've done your part to clean it up as best as you can. Mark?
Yeah, room sure gets quiet when you start talking about amends. I wonder what that's the quietest it's been the whole weekend. I wonder what that's about. I know what that's about. When I started talking about my grandmother and great aunt, I almost started crying. So I know what that's about. I just want to share a little my experience. Joe certainly went over some of his experience and how we make amends. And I walk up to people and say, gee, I'm here to tell you I'm sorry. Because I tried that one too, and I got the same response Joe did. Yeah, you are sorry and have been for many, many years. What's new and different? I'll take my last time. A couple of them are humorous, and one of them, some of you may or may not have experience with this. It has to do with the Internal Revenue Service. And when I got sober in 82, I hadn't filed for about 7 years. They don't like that. And the first time through the work with Don, I had gone ahead and done all that, and he did the smart thing. He directed me to a CPA, and we went through and did all that. And so I went down and I set that deal up, and I paid that one off after a period of time. But I'm a good alcoholic, and God rewarded me with some real good income in my recovery. And being a good alcoholic and being selfish, I didn't set up enough withholdings for a couple of years in recovery, and so I owed them a bunch, and I had been in the process of paying that back. And then when I came down to Texas in 1991 and did a bunch of work in a hospital, the last thing in my mind, nor did I have any ability to continue my monthly deal with them. And so what had happened is when I got out of that hospital and I went forth with doing some work, occasionally I would send them a little money, but this last time through, a lot of healing had taken place, and so I became very, very willing to make that amend. But here's how this works for me in this thing called amends. I had literally sat down and sat down with Gerald, and we'd taken a look at that, and we'd done some computation, looking at my income about how much I can pay, and I've got strong willingness, and that's almost like on a Friday, and I walk in Monday, and what they said was, Mark, your wages have been guaranteed by the Internal Revenue Service. And I laughed. She's not in recovery. She can't figure out why I'm laughing. Hell, I know why. I said, I'm willing. They said, okay, we found you. So I had set aside an amount that I felt I could pay them, $525 a month. So I picked up the phone. I called the guy. I was honest with him. I told him exactly what happened. I went in and got some help for what they call PTSD, and quite frankly, I didn't care a whole lot about you all. But I do now, and I'm here to take care of this. And so he asked me a whole bunch of questions, and he gets done, and he says, well, if you'll send us $510 a month, that'll be okay. So I very, very gratefully send them $510 a month right now, and I'll just do that up till the day I'm done. And one of the benefits and gifts for me in going through the work on a fairly consistent basis is there's not a lot of them. I did some work with a guy. He's about 8 years, a little over 8 years sober, and he had sat in a workshop we were doing, and I kept noticing, at 8 years sober, his eyes are getting huge, and it kind of alarms you a little bit. And well, what had happened was in 8 years he'd never ever done the work, never knew what was wrong with himself. So by the time he got done with inventory, here he is 8 years sober, and he had about 200 resentments and finances and stuff all the place, and I've watched a lot of miracles take place for him in that area, but a couple others, and I'm like Joe. I lived in a lot of states. I'm a geographic alcoholic in California and Oregon and Washington and Alaska, and you get to that process about the willingness, and these people I've harmed in those states are not going to hop on a plane, come to my house, and say you can make amends to me now. And so what happened is I was going along from my first set of amends, and it took me about 5 years to totally finish all of those on that first time through. But there were in particular three or four out in Seattle, and what happens for me is I do everything I can on a consistent daily basis, but I reached a place where there's a lot of gnawing going on, and I know what that's about. There's four women out in Seattle, Washington, and I'd been married to one, engaged to two, and dated the other one, and I hopped the plane and I went out there, and I knew where two of them were, and I hooked up with some of my old friends out there, and I found out where the other two were, and they all lived and or worked within 2 miles of each other in Seattle, Washington. So I went and set up the appointments, and that's where I learned the lesson Joe talked about. I sat across from my wife, and what I was proceeding to do was try and tell her how I harmed her. And she stopped me and said, you're still being the same pompous gentleman you always were. How do you know how you harm me? And I thought, I think I missed something in the book. And we're still good friends today. And I finished that amend. And then I got to go to those other three women that day and clean that up. And another reason this room got quiet, those of you who have made amends, feeling the grace and the power and gaining access to God happens to me in this process of amends at a deeper level than any other thing I do. And I don't know why. I don't care why. One of the gifts in the program is I quit asking why. I just keep taking action. And that was a healing deal. I think the amend with my father, I come from the kind of family, it's okay to talk about the sports and the weathers, but for God's sakes, don't get into any other areas. And when I went to make amends to him, like, you kind of start to say some things, and he just stopped me and said, look, I'm just real glad you're happy and sober and that kind of stuff. But I never felt free of that, and he died in 1986, and last summer when I went up to Breckenridge, I'd done some prayer before I went up, and I turned around and I wrote him a letter. And in that letter, I wrote the things that I would like to have said to him if he could have perhaps allowed me to do that. And So I went to a store and I bought some flowers and I went out to the VA because my father died in 86 with the Hideous Four Horsemen on his shoulders, and I went out to the VA gravesite, and those of you who know what those look like, Yeah, it's a needle in a haystack, and I'd only been there twice and had the same experience Joe did. I prayed and I got directed, and I literally walked right up to it again, and I, you know, I got down on my knees and read that letter and got free. Just moves me. It's wonderful to be able to sit here and feel that moved. But I got free of that thing, you know, and I'm like Joe. Three-fourths of the room says, no, can't do that, you know. Then I got these spiritual gunfires that said, if God tells you to do it, you go do it, man. So I've had some experiences with that. Incredible, over and over again. And again, I'm like Joe. The word all is what sticks to mind for me. Yeah, I was talking to a gentleman last night, and I told him something, and I remember this during amends. Recovery has never, ever ask me to do anything that remotely resembles what alcohol asked me to do. This asked me to go sit across from people that I've harmed, institutions, people, and sit across from them and go through that process that Joe talked about. It asked me to write inventory. It asked me to help others. Stop for a minute and think about what alcohol asked you to do. You know, given a choice, take the amend that you think is the most difficult one you got, and take a T-bar and you lay that alongside what happened to you behind booze, and then you come to me and tell me that you're not willing to go make that amend. Are you willing to go drink alcohol? See, this thing gets real easy for me. It really gets easy. Do I like it? No. Anyone who tells you they like amends, I think they're lying. You know, it goes against everything that's the root of my disease. But I go do them. And yeah, I'll tell you what I like. I love it when it's over. Okay? I love it when it's over, but that's my experience with the thing, and you hear a lot of that stuff. I'll be making amends till the day I die. And they're not talking about the kind Joe talked about where you're interacting with the mother and father. It's like Don tells a story where he went to make amends to his mother, and she said, well, I only just want you to be happy, so every time he sees his mother, he's happy. So he'll do that up till the day he dies, but we're talking about amends you have a conscious awareness at that you can take some action on and move into. But that's it's powerful, powerful stuff. A lot of instructions in the book, very, very specific about what to do, and that's where we'll move into now.
Here's an interesting exercise. Next time you start the work, those of you that are considering doing the steps again or for the first time, before you even move into step one, or while you're looking at step one, make a list of five people that you have no willingness to go to, but you know you owe amends. And see if the willingness, see the shift in power that's taken place when you get to nine. Just list five people that you know that you will absolutely never, ever be able to go to on your own power. And then watch what happens when you're in the ninth step if there hasn't been a shift, a dramatic shift in power, awareness, and perception from that list of five people you wrote down when you started the work. There's a practical exercise to show you the shift in consciousness and power and perception from the time you start step one till you're into amends. I lived with resentment and hatred toward a man since my earliest memory. And he was 57 years old when I was born, my father. And he was 67 years old by the time I was 10. So you can imagine being 10 years old with a father that's 67, and you want him to show up for baseball and Cub Scouts and all that stuff, and he's not there, and the other guy's fathers are. And isn't it kind of sad, isn't it kind of funny, actually, that I did 12 years of therapy, different kinds, to find out that my earliest memory was resentful. I think that's a joke on me. I never knew how to get free of that resentment. All I knew how to do was get some temporary relief from it. And I could bang on chairs or take one of those rubber things and put his face on you and beat you or talk about it in group or share it at 10 meetings or call five people in AA and talk about how I felt about him. And all I got was temporary relief. And I think relief is a big deal when you're new, because you probably haven't had any for a long time. But I think there comes a time, I hope for everyone in this room, where relief is no longer enough and you want some real freedom. And I told you the other night that I would show you the difference between relief and freedom, where after all I knew to do, after a period of time in AA and all that I had tried to get free of my feelings toward my father, I simply did what I was asked to do in the first 8 steps. And I saw my part with every resentment I ever had toward him. And you say to yourself, how does a 10-year-old kid see his fault toward a father that was 67 by the time he was 10? Well, I'll tell you what I saw. I saw a 10-year-old kid that was playing God 2 years before he ever took a drink, because he knew how old that man should have been, how that man should have been, what that man should have been doing better than God Almighty himself. And if that ain't playing God, I don't know what is. And I was playing God way before I ever took a drink. And I saw my part, and I started to get free. In the fourth column of my resentment inventory, I started to experience in my heart forgiveness for a man that I hated since my earliest memory. And I went to a noon meeting, and I said, you know, I'm in the fourth column for the first time, and I've hated my father since I can remember. And today I was writing about my father, and I was writing my part in the fourth column, and I started to experience some forgiveness. Does anyone in the room think I can go to that man and ever make amends? He's been dead since I was 21. And 3/4 of the room said, can't make amends to someone who's dead. Can't do that. And like I said last night, anytime a room in AA or someone in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous or your own mind begins to tell you you can't, that is not the fact that you can't, it is merely their or your agnosticism. Because they're not saying you can't. You know what they're saying? God isn't everything. And I heard their agnosticism, but the other 1/4 of the room, like a lot of you here today, said, sure you can. Do what Don tells you when you get to the 9th step. We know him. We know this process. We know what we've done. Go for it. They gave me some hope to move on in that inventory. Because if I would have believed the ones that said there was nothing I could do but cope with it, deal with it, work on it, maybe get a therapist, I'd already done all that. I would have quit and I wouldn't have finished that inventory on that man, because I'd done everything I ever could to get free of those feelings I had for him for 30 years, since my earliest memory. But it was because of you people that said, of course you can, because God is either everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. That got me to go on through that 4th column. And when I got to the 8th step, I wrote that letter just like I was face to face and followed the same format as if I was sitting in a room with him. This is why I'm here. This is the harm I'm clear on. Is there any other? Do you need to tell me how any of this hurt you? And what can I do to possibly make it right? Can you forgive me? And isn't that interesting? Forgiveness for an alcoholic sure comes easy when it's the very thing we're seeking from them. That's when we're able to give it. And when you see the number of people that you're seeking forgiveness from, you'll sure be able to give it a lot more freely, because we are terribly selfish people. But when it's something we want, we'll give it ourselves. And I went to Battle Creek, Michigan, and I went to his grave, and I sat there and I read that letter, and I sat there in prayer. And I walked out of that graveyard to a car that I had rented and was headed back to the airport. And this quiet little voice said, no, you're taking a drive. And I'd taken this drive 3 or 4 times in Battle Creek, sober, and was never free. You know those places that still kind of pull on you when you see them? That bar, that guy's house. And I took that drive around Battle Creek, Michigan, past places I'd lived and grown up, and the ghetto where I did drugs and the bars where I drank, and nothing had a hold on me anymore. And more than that, I got free of resentments that never have come back to this day, and it wasn't temporary relief. Because I found out something about relief. It's always temporary. But freedom isn't. Real freedom, the real kind of freedom they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, is not temporary. I wanted to touch on a few things on page 77. Once again, as they do with each step, they tell me the real purpose for amends on line number 3 is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. You start making amends to feel better, you'll have a rude awakening. even though you'll probably feel better. If your motive is to feel better, you probably won't. If your motive isn't to feel better, but this, you'll probably feel better. There's another paradox, just like the one I mentioned earlier. If you live a life where you're totally consumed with how you feel at every given moment, and how you feel is the most important thing, you probably won't feel good most of the time. But if you start to live a life where how other people feel most of the time is more important than how you feel, you'll probably feel good most of the time. My real purpose. Next two lines talk about it's seldom wise to go to somebody who's still smarts. That just tells me, pray about when to go for each and every one. A friend of mine had one to Walgreens. Flew home to Minnesota to the Walgreens that he actually stole from. Sat out front, the thought was, not now. He trusted it. Flew back to Colorado, sat out front of a Walgreens, not now. He wondered why. I got the money, I'm willing to do it, there's no resistance. Came back to Denver a few months later, went to another Walgreens, main headquarters, the feeling was, now's the time. Went in, headed toward the main office, pay back some money, saw a coffee shop for employees. Went in and got a cup of coffee, sat down for a minute to say a prayer. He's sitting with a man who's doing the books. Makes amends to the guy. It's the head bookkeeper. He finished the amends. The guy says, no problem. Mail your money to this address. But I have a drinking problem. Will you help me? My sponsor had a truck route when he got out of the penitentiary. And on that truck route was a family he owed amends to because he had terribly hurt the son who had died. Every day for a year and a half, he passed that house and he would ask, is today the day? And the answer would be no. One day the answer was yes. He went to that door and knocked on the door and made amends to that family. The first thing out of the father's mouth was, we couldn't have seen you one day sooner, but we need your help with blah, 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 blah. So it's good to pray about when the right time is. Another point was, three lines from the bottom of that paragraph, our man is going to be more impressed with a desire to set right the wrong. Boy, if you had to use four words to sum up what amends are, there's the four words I would use. It also says he's going to be more interested in a demonstration than my talk. Boy, there's a guiding principle for living your life, huh? Toward the bottom of the next paragraph, it talks about it's harder to go to an enemy than a friend. The last paragraph talks about we never criticize. We don't take their inventory, their faults are not discussed. Mark?
Oh, I'm just going to pick up. Joe's covered a lot of... I've got some personal experience with the enemy, and what the book tells me is exactly what happened to me. It was much more beneficial to me. And it tells me how to go to him, a helpful and forgiving spirit. Again, if you go on, you're getting some more specific instructions. Never criticize. We will never get over our drinking till we've done our utmost to straighten out the past. Gee, that might be a good question. Have you done your utmost to straighten out your past?
Where is that?
Bottom of 77. We're there to sweep off our side of the street. Realizing nothing worthwhile can be accomplished till we do so. That's both a warning and a promise. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own.
I think there's two comments there. There's two questions there that he just covered that would be worthwhile questions for us to ask ourselves. Do I really believe? Here's a great question to ask yourself during amends. Same question I raised earlier. Do I think making these amends has anything to do with whether I drink again or not? Here's the question. Do I really believe that I might never get over drinking until I have done my utmost to straighten out the past? And do I really believe, have I realized, that nothing, not a few things, not some stuff, that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until I've done so?
Talks about our manner. I still remember reading this, thinking to myself, they're not describing my normal state of mind. If my manner is calm, frank, and open, I'll be gratified with the results. Goes on to talk about the unexpected will happen, and I've certainly had a lot of experience with that. And rarely do I make satisfactory progress. Tells us some things that will happen, and virtually all these have at one time. This is important because I had this happen. Should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. I had one amend which really summed up the harm. And it's one that, if you ask me before I went in, it was the mother of a lady that I dated in Seattle. And I had seen some harm, and had seen where I was at fault, and I went to make those amends and to both her and her husband, and I'm sitting in their living room, and when I asked what I could do to balance the books, and she basically looked at me and said, "I don't ever want to see you again. I don't ever want you interacting with any of my family members." And a lot of anger came out, and she went on to tell me of all the harm I'd created, which when I'd ask her that question, she really didn't have much to say. And I remember leaving there, and thank God for this part in the book. But I got a chance to see what happens to me when I'm out there. And I've had a couple of those in sobriety doing the same thing. And so there's a reason this is in the book, because if you're like me, this is probably going to happen. Doesn't matter. Tells me it's water over the dam. I've made my demonstration, done my part. The next part's on money. One paragraph, it's no bones in this one. We don't dodge our creditors, which we've been doing all our life. We're going to tell them what we're trying to do. Make no bones about our drinking. They know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. We're not afraid of disclosing our alcoholism and the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. That means the IRS. And it tells us what to do, arranging the best deal we can. Now, I'll tell you one of the things my ego did for me. I'm an alcoholic. If I owe $5,000, what I want to do is come up to you with $100 bills all at once time. Don't ask me to give you $10 a month for 20 years. You see what I'm saying? But what it's gotten down to is I got a list of these people and I go to them, because if I wait to be able to walk up to lay $5,000 down, I'm not going to make that amend. So I go to them and I do what it says. I arrange the best deal I can. Call it a warning, call it a promise. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. Joe summed up something. Gary Brown, 26 years sober, what did he do? Sat down with his wife, sold his house, sold everything he owned to clean this up, got more free than he'd ever been. You know, are you willing to go to any length? Are you really willing to do that? How far are you willing to go to do this thing? Boy, those are important. You want to get in touch with what's between you and God? Sit down and make a list of all the people you owe money and take a look at what you got and ask yourself what you're willing to get rid of. How far are you willing to go? I'll let you talk about the next one, Joe. You got a lot more experience about the criminal offense than I do.
All right, Mr. Nice Guy.
I just didn't get caught.
He's just a nice guy that drank a little too much. There was a joke in my home group because we tease some of the girls in our group, some of the alcoholic girls. When they try to convince us in our meeting that they were just really nice girls who drank a little too much, we tease them about that. And the joke really ended up being on me, because my girlfriend came to our group and found out she was not an alcoholic. And so my buddy tells me that I ended up with a nice girl who just drank a little too much. There are specific examples here about money, criminal offenses, when others are involved, domestic problems you'll find scattered throughout these next few pages. But there's also a statement on page 81 that says, whatever the situation, we have to do something about it. First line of the second paragraph. I think one of my examples that encompasses some of those is an armed robbery I committed when I was 18.
with a buddy of mine, and so I'm considering this amends, and but he was involved, and he was also one of my amends. And I asked him if I could make amends for this armed robbery he and I had committed and beaten in court, because the only witness was persuaded by a friend of ours from the penitentiary that he probably shouldn't testify, and he refused to testify, and we walked out of the courtroom. Of course, he was persuaded in a nice way. It was all friendly and up and up. So I asked my friend that was involved, can I make amends for this armed robbery you and I committed? He said, sure, just don't mention my name. Don't involve me. He was married, and he never went to trial. I did. His name had never come up. So it says we have brains to use, and I secured a lawyer. And the lawyer did some investigating and found out the statute of limitations was up, and went to the police because one of the detectives was severely harmed. And he wasn't impressed. He said I was lucky the statute of limitations was up, and what I could do was not ever live in Battle Creek, Michigan ever again. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't ever want to live in Battle Creek, Michigan ever again anyway, and I'm willing to fulfill that amends. The judge I had to go to, because he was a friend of my father's, and he forgave me and was happy about what I was doing. And then I had to go to the owner of the business that I robbed, and he was dead, and his wife sat and listened to me and was very happy about what I was doing and wished me well. And I had to be willing to do that because I want to be free of the past, to be here with you in this moment. And I don't ever want to drink again. And I sincerely believe, because of the guilt that I lived with all of my life, that with that kind of guilt, I will drink again. And I get to get free. And I didn't have to muster up the power or the willingness to do that. It came from making a lot of other amends and realizing that I was going to drink again if I didn't. Nothing worse than getting away with a period of sobriety, thinking you're fine, not knowing where you could possibly be taken, thinking that you're fine because you haven't drank for 5 or 10 years and you're probably going to get away with it. And then one day you're one of these people who just drank and probably died or didn't die. I don't know which would be worse. There's a principle here on the bottom of 81 that talks about, God willing, my behavior won't be repeated. It's not about making amends and then continuing to do the same stuff and making amends for the same stuff over and over. But I certainly have to admit to you that there's been a lot that I've had to go back to and make amends for doing the same thing that I made amends to the year before. Yes, I've had to do that, and I don't want to keep living like that. I don't want to keep doing that. I like the paragraph on the bottom of 82 where it says, the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking who says that sobriety is enough. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He's like a farmer who comes out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined, and to his wife he says, don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? Coming out of your own lives with a life around you that's in shambles, living in that lie that nothing's really wrong, and then you move through that inventory in the fifth step in 6, 7, and 8, and all of a sudden you're seeing the devastation that you've caused all around you. The first 8 steps bring me out of that cyclone cellar to clearly see what's going on around me, to come out of that kind of lie. Next page talks about there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. I was at a meeting one day in Brentwood, California. That's one of the ritzy sections near Beverly Hills. And a guy was impersonating Sonny Barger, the president, ex-president of the Hell's Angels. And I thought to myself, You know, I didn't know at the time, but later when I found out he was an imposter, I thought, you know, only in AA would somebody fake being Sonny Barger to get attention. It's like the meeting I walked into one day and they had no steps on the wall or traditions or a big book, and the meeting had already started, and they were sharing around the room, but nobody said they were alcoholic or not, and they're just sharing. And I wondered if I was in an AA meeting, and then somebody said, you know, I think I'm the most selfish, self-centered person in the room, and then they spent the rest of the meeting debating, no, I am, no, I am, and I absolutely knew. Only in AA would people find conversation or virtue in the fact that they're the most selfish, self-centered person in the room. And this guy's impersonating Sonny Barger. He tells a horror story to these ritzy people. And they're supposed to ask questions for 15 minutes after his talk. And the room was so scared, nobody would raise their hand. And I was a little intimidated. I raised my hand. I said, Sonny, you and I have some similar stuff in our background with crime and such. Can you share with us some of your experience with amends? He said, not really. I was told except when to do so would injure them or others, and I'm others, and if it's going to hurt...